Today's Teisho will be on case 13 in the Mu Meng Quan, the Wu Meng Quan, the gate gate of no barrier. Case 13 is entitled Tokusan Holds His Bowls. One day, Tokusan went down toward the dining room holding his bowls. Seppo met him and asked, "Where are you off to with your bowls? The bell has not rung, the drum has not sounded." Tokusan turned back and went to his room. Seppo mentioned this to Ganto, who remarked, "Tokusan is renowned, but he does not know the last word." Tokusan heard about this remark and sent his attendant to fetch Ganto. "You do not approve of me?" he asked. Ganto whispered his meaning. Tokusan said nothing at the time, but the next day he ascended the rostrum, and behold, he was very different from usual. Ganto, going toward the front of the hall, clapped his hands and laughed loudly, saying, "Congratulations, our old man has got hold of the last word. From now on, nobody in this whole country can outdo him." Umon's comment: as for the last word, neither Ganto nor Tokusan has ever dreamed of it. When you look into the matter, you find that they are like puppets on the shelf. Umon's verse: you must realize the first. If you realize the first, you master the last. The first and the last are not one word. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen today on this beautiful summer morning. Thank you so much for honoring and taking good care of the Buddha nature in yourself. At some point in your life, you became aware of that Buddha nature. Something said to you, "Go sit on a cushion." Something said to you, "Try this." You came into the Zendo and you sat down and you struggled with your breath. But all the time, something in you was saying, "Do this, do this, do this." And I want to thank you for being so faithful to that teacher. Thank you for getting up early. Thank you for coming here. Thank you for practicing wholeheartedly. Today in the Zendo, we had beautiful sitting, beautiful sitting. Thank you so much for that. This is a story about a very famous Zen master named Tokusan. And Tokusan in his day was quite renowned as a really, really great Zen teacher. This takes place in a temple, which is a little bit like a sesshin. At sesshin, as you know, we all eat at the same time. There are appointed times to eat. And in our group, we leave our bowls on the table. But in a classical Zen temple in China or Japan, each monk or nun has his or her bowl behind him or her in the sitting hall. So when it's mealtime, people grab their bowls and pick them up and carry them into the dining hall. This is like usually how it's done. So in this case, Seppo, one of Tokusan's senior monks, senior students, sees his old teacher, Tokusan, walking down towards the dining room. In a Chinese temple, the dining hall was separate from the Zendo. And actually, that was separate from the Buddha Hall, where people recited the sutras. So you would recite the sutras in one building, you would do zazen in another building, and the dining hall was in yet another building. So if you imagine beautiful Chinese-style buildings around a courtyard, that would be a temple, and Ganto sees his teacher coming out of the zendo with his bowls in his hand and walking towards the kitchen, towards the dining hall. And Seppo says, where are you off to with those bowls? The bell has not rung, the drum has not sounded. Tokusan turned and went back to his room. Then Seppo, the monk who saw Tokusan doing this, mentioned this to another monk, his friend Ganto, who Seppo and Ganto became very, very famous Zen masters too in their time. And Ganto says to Seppo, well, you know, Tokusan is very famous, but he hasn't really finished his training. Even though everybody says he's a great master, he doesn't know the last word of Zen. He still doesn't know the last word of Zen. So this is the story. There's a little bit more. Apparently, this gets back to Tokusan, and Tokusan meets with Ganto, and he says, you don't approve of me. And Ganto tells him the message, his secret communication. So this is the koan. And I think it's a very important koan. I hope we'll have a chance to do it together. Some of you may be somewhat news junkies, as I am. And so most of the last 3 or 4 days were consumed by Trumpery. And so Trump went to Europe and insulted all our allies. He slapped them in the face, and then they all had a wonderful time being slapped in the face and insulted. And he said he kicked them in the butt and shaped them up, and now NATO was better than ever. And then he went to Great Britain, and in an interview he insulted the Prime Minister, who's teetering on the edge of her government collapsing in a vote of no confidence. He said her chief rival would make a good prime minister. So it was that kind of a week, right? We live with that every day, right? But now it's spreading, the madness is spreading to Europe. So, you know, there was so much, it was such a busy news week, and Trump, as usual, was keeping himself at the forefront of everybody's mind all the time. That you might not have noticed another story, which was in the New York, which is a very popular story in the New York Times. You know, the largest one of the largest Buddhist organizations in the United States is called the Shambhala organization. Is Shambhala, Shambhala, Shambhala. The word Shambhala refers to a mythical Buddhist kingdom somewhere in north of India. So in a Buddhist legend and culture, there's a sort of like a myth or a legend about this kingdom, which was deeply enlightened and dedicated to awakening. And it was called Shambhala, Shambhala, Shambhala. Nobody really knows where it is. Some people think it was, there's speculation. Different places in Buddhist history are candidates for being the real identity of Shambhala. That's really an academic issue in a way, although there were places like that. There was a place called Gandhara, which is now in Afghanistan. You might remember when they the zealots blew up those Buddhas. Well, that place, Gandhara, was once a vibrant Buddhist society in the north of India. And much of what we practice in Zen may have come from Gandhara. The Mahayana may have begun in Gandhara. So many people think that Gandhara was the Shambhala of legend. So Shambhala is an organization that was founded by a very controversial teacher named Chogyam Trungpa. And Trungpa was a very strange man. You know, he was a brilliant, brilliant teacher. If you ever have a chance to read any of his books, I think you'll agree that they're absolutely captivating. He was a Tibetan tulku. He was thought to be the reincarnation of a previous teacher. And he fled Tibet in the 50s. And he actually wound up going to Oxford University. And then he began to teach Tibetan Buddhism, his particular lineage of Tibetan Buddhism, first in Scotland, and then in the United States, in Vermont, and a little bit in Nova Scotia, and he made his home base Boulder, Colorado. So back in the hippie days, Boulder was like the hippie Mecca. I myself was a hippie, and I myself went to Boulder. And I can attest to what a cool place it was. It's the perfect place for a new Gandhara, right? It's in the mountains. It's beautiful. There's a river in the center of town. In those days, it wasn't very developed, and this man Trungpa started teaching there. And when he would teach, hundreds and hundreds of people would show up. So Trungpa created this organization called Shambhala, and he has a central location in Boulder, and then there's a monastery in Nova Scotia, in Halifax. And there's also one in Vermont. If you ever go up to Vermont, if you're driving down the interstate, you'll see there are no signs on the interstate in Vermont except for one sign that's a non-directional sign. It says, Tail of the Tiger, and there's an arrow in the interstate. And that's to the Shambhala's meditation center in Vermont. And it's a nice little place. So anyway, Trungpa was this very, very dynamic teacher who gathered around him thousands of students. When he would speak, he's a very charismatic person, and you can see tapes of him delivering his talks. At any rate, he created this organization called Shambhala, and it has 200 locations in the Western world, and it has probably a membership of about 10,000 people. So after Trungpa died, eventually the whole organization was given to his son. And his son, I think, is now around 50, something like that, maybe a little younger than that. But his organization is now engulfed in scandal because a bunch of people have come forward, primarily women, in the spirit of the Me Too movement. And they have, one particular woman is actually quite a long-term student of the Shambhala organization, in the Shambhala tradition. And she interviewed many people who were molested by this guy. And she meticulously, she's a researcher and a very intelligent and articulate woman. And she gathered accounts of people being in some way or another sexually harassed or sexually molested by this teacher. And she sort of collected volume one, and then she collected volume two, and she put them online. And this has created, as you can well understand, this has created a huge scandal. And the New York Times story was all about it. It was front page news, and it was one of the top stories for a number of days in the New York Times. We've seen these scandals before, but it's always a bit of a shock, right, when this happens. This is a person who's highly respected as a teacher of Vajrayana Buddhism. And in some of these accounts, he's behaving like a person who, he's behaving like a frat boy, like a drunken frat boy. And in fact, in many of the stories, he's actually drunk. You know, so, I can only feel sorry and sad about something like this, right? Because this is a wonderful organization. You know, I have to say that I have many friends who were very attracted to Trungpa's teachings and who became students of his particular way of teaching. And by the way, one of his most famous students is Pema Chodron. If you're a Pema Chodron fan, she's probably one of the best-selling writers on Buddhism in the Western, in the English-speaking world. And she really lives at the monastery in Halifax, Nova Scotia. But she speaks all over the world, and she's an absolutely super person, in my opinion. And even though, this organization has produced some really amazing people. There's a teacher in Colorado, in Boulder, named Reginald Ray. If you have ever read any of his books, they're wonderful books. He's a wonderful teacher. So, you know, I know a large number of people who came out of this organization who were really, whose lives were really saved by these teachings. People who had serious psychological dysfunctions, who, you know, read Trungpa's books and began to meditate and went to retreats, and whose lives were really completely transformed. I mean, I know people who, you know, I'm amazed they're not in jail, seriously, or dead, you know, from substance abuse, and they're really happy, high-functioning people. You know, and I think it's thanks to the Shambhala organization, and thanks to really this particular lineage of teaching that started with Trungpa. But you know, it's not just embarrassing when something like this happens. You have to wonder how it happens, right? And you also have to. I also feel so sorry for people because you know, people trusted this guy. You know, they really honored, you know, many of these people. There's 10,000 people who practice in this tradition, and, you know, I would guess that probably 5,000 of them have a little picture of him on the altars of their meditation rooms, and probably a picture of him in their private homes as well. And, you know, these are people who you know, get up every day and meditate and look at his picture, and they're trying to be like him. Trying to be like him. And then, you know, maybe they get up in the morning and they look at his picture and they do their practice, and then they sit down for a cup of coffee and they open the New York Times, and there it is, this big scandal, volume one and volume two. And, you know, that situation has happened to many people in the world, not just Buddhists. It's happened to Catholics, it's happened to Jewish people, you know, it happens in all traditions. It happens in secular tradition too. You know, one of my favorite, there was a professor in the English department when I arrived at Rutgers. I won't give you his last name, and I probably shouldn't give you his first name either. But when I met him, I was blown away by what a super person he was. I thought he was the embodiment of everything I admired. He was a kind, generous. He was a Marxist, but he wasn't an angry Marxist. He was a funny Marxist. You know, he was very sophisticated. And then it came to my attention that he was having affairs with his graduate students, and some of the graduate students he had affairs with were my students too, and they were very devastated by his behavior. In fact, eventually one of my friends, the chair of the department, had to exercise institutional force against this guy. So. This happens in all walks of life. And when it happens, it's a real challenge. You know, it's a real challenge. The story of Tokusan is just a little story, right? Tokusan hasn't slept with anybody, and he wasn't caught molesting anybody at a drunken party, fortunately, right? His infraction was just that he's a Zen master, and he's supposed to always be on top of things. And yet, basically he's on the way to the kitchen in the middle of the day, and his student says, "What the hell are you doing? You know, this isn't dinner time. I thought you were supposed to be enlightened." That's a small version of the big scandal that's happening in the world of Shambhala Buddhism. And when you're a teacher, somebody you trust, betrays you or lets you down, it's a real koan. It's a real koan. You know, I feel so sorry for some of these women in this organization who, really trusted this person. And some of the narratives are pretty hard to read. You know, it would be like if you are helping the Dalai Lama, and you go to a party, and then the Dalai Lama starts, throwing back brews, right, or glasses of wine, and then you go into the bathroom, and the Dalai Lama follows you in and tries to start kissing you, right, and fondling your body. That would be a pretty big letdown, right? You know, we just hope the Dalai Lama doesn't do that, right? But in this case, somebody that these people think of as like the Dalai Lama has done that. And I have to say, this has happened in the Zen world too. You know, I studied for a while with a teacher in New York State who was like a genius. Yeah, I'm not kidding. I had finished my training, and when I came to New Jersey, I was trying to get tenure at Rutgers, and I didn't have time to start this group, and I started sitting with this group in New York, and I met this teacher who was like a genius. I mean, doing koans with him was the most amazing thing. You know, when we do a sesshin, and we do koan training at sesshin, I always ask people to tell me their koans, because, I forget what koan. He never forgot. And there would be 100 people at the sesshin. And I would walk in and I'd start, I remember your koan, And he had this amazing mind. And his way of teaching was, it was like going to graduate school. And then I discovered that this guy had been sleeping with some of his students. You know, when this happens, it's the worst thing that can happen to you in your life, right? And yet, I'd like to say that even though it's a terrible thing when this happens, and even though it's very painful for everybody involved, and even though it's not good for Buddhism's public relations image in the United States, it's actually very good in a certain way if people can understand the situation properly, if they treat it like a koan. You know, when I first met my teacher, Genki Roshi, it was like literally love at first sight, you know? I have to say that I've been married to my wife for 40 years. It wasn't love at first sight, you know? We were working together at a restaurant, and we would have political arguments, you know, because I've always been politically more sophisticated than my wife. And she always thought she was more sophisticated than I was. So, you know, for a while, it was, she was, in some ways, we would have political discussions, and she was the last person on earth I would want to marry. But when I, but it's worked out pretty well. But when I met Genki Roshi, it was love at first sight. You know, I just, there was something about him that just moved me so deeply. And, you know, he would come into the room and literally my heart would beat. I mean, when I would sit down next to him in the Zendo, my heart would be beating. And, you know, I loved Genki Roshi in a way that I have never loved anybody else. You know, he was the embodiment of wisdom for me. You know, and he was the embodiment of wisdom for me for a number of years, you know. I've told this story before, but when I've been practicing with Genki Roshi for a couple of years. And I was walking down the street at University Avenue in Seattle, coming out of the class, out of my graduate class, and I was walking down the street. And even though I was already married, you know, one of the things I liked to do when I walked down the street was look at all the beautiful women. And so, you know, I wasn't just going down the street to look at beautiful women, but it was part of the ritual of walking down the street for me. You know, there were shops I liked to go into. I would go into the bookstore and browse books. And every once in a while I'd notice, oh my gosh, what a beautiful woman. And I would feel very happy, you know. And so one day I'm walking down the street and I'm looking at beautiful women walking by and I'm looking at books. And suddenly I see Genki Roshi coming in the other direction. And I was so ashamed of myself that I actually was panicky. And I jumped into this store until he walked by, and I was sort of hiding, watching him walk by in the darkness, because I didn't want him to see me when I was having these prurient thoughts, you know? And I was so ashamed of myself. So, you know, Genki Roshi to me was like the embodiment of enlightenment. You know, you know, the truth is that when I got to know him, he was a wonderful person, but, you know, he was also a human being, right? He was also a human being. And he could be, you know, this person who at first was the Buddha himself for me, right? And by the way, he was unfailingly kind and patient and supportive as a teacher. He was a wonderful teacher. And he was also a very deep practitioner of Zen. But, you know, when I got to know him, I was eventually his attendant. He could be incredibly immature, right? You know, so one of the things he used to do is borrow money from everybody in the Zen group. And he wouldn't spend it on himself. It's not like he was, but he would say, let's go out to lunch. You know, I'll take you to lunch. And then he actually, you know, the guy would wind up paying. And he would borrow money from everybody. You know, at one point we discovered that he had borrowed money from pretty much everybody who had money in the group, you know. And it's a complicated story, but, you know, he could be very irresponsible. You know, so we used to have meditation every morning at 7 o'clock in the morning in South Seattle. People would get up at, you know, 5:30, and shower and shave, and or shower, and they wouldn't necessarily shave, right? If there were women in the group, they would shower and, you know, whatever,
and jump in the car, and we'd all drive down there to South Seattle and sit together in the morning. And then we'd have a Japanese-style breakfast, and people would go off to their jobs. You know, and Genki Roshi some days would just call me up, and he'd say, listen, let's cancel the sit tomorrow morning. And I'd say, Genki Roshi, you know, I don't have everybody's number, and even if I have their number, you know, I can't necessarily contact everybody. People are planning to be there tomorrow morning. He said, well, we should cancel it. So, you know, people would go, and then there'd be a sign on the door saying, canceled. And they would be furious, right? And I would, you know, so this kind of thing, Genki Roshi could be very childish. He could be irresponsible. And I could go on and on, you know, about, and when I began to see Genki Roshi in this other light, I sort of had a crisis. Really, it was like a crisis. Because, you know, I had made him out to be something so wonderful. And he was all of those things, but when I began to see the human side of him, you know, I really got mad. I got really mad, you know, at him. And I think this is a stage in people's practice, actually. You know, where, you know, you meet somebody who seems to be the embodiment of wisdom, and then you get to know them. And, you know, I think often in Buddhist communities, what can happen is that the students become very angry at the teacher. Maybe not consciously, but it's like they feel a little let down. And it doesn't have to be a big deal. It doesn't have to be that the teacher is sleeping with somebody. You know, there was a very famous Zen master named Yasutani Roshi. He's very famous. And I read that one of his students left him because he used to like marshmallows. And he, in his begging bag, in Japan, monks have a little begging bag that they go when they go begging for food or money on the street. They have a little bag that they keep their bowl in. And in his begging bag, he always had a bag of marshmallows, and he would eat them all day long. And his student just couldn't abide that, right? So, you know, in Yasutani's case, it's a small offense, right, to eat marshmallows. In Genki Roshi's case, you know, being free and easy with other people's money is a problem, but it's not like a hanging offense, right? You know, in the case of this guy who has sexually molested his students, that's very serious. It's really wrong, and he should be removed. He should be removed, and he should not be back, you know, in my opinion. But it's good for his students. There are students who are going to walk away now and say, this was all a sham. See, he was a fraud, right? They'll say that. This was a sham. You know, and by the way, if you look at the story in the New York Times and you read the comments from the viewers, people will say, just goes to show, you know, Buddhism is a big sham. It's a lie, you know, this happens in all religions, power corrupts, blah, blah, blah. The real lesson here is more complicated. You know, something really happened to me when I met Genki Roshi. Something really happened to me. It was real. And it was deeply transformative, you know. And I think something was real and deeply transformative when many of these people met this teacher, the teacher in question. But it's easy to misunderstand what's happening in that moment. You know, what we do is we imagine what's really happening, if you'd like my opinion on it, is that you have in yourself an enlightened teacher. It's called Buddha nature. And, you know, in me, Buddha nature was asleep. Or it did not dare to raise its head. because like so many people, I was so confused and unhappy. And when I met Genki Roshi and started meditating with Genki Roshi, something came to life in me. Something came to life in me. It's called, in Sanskrit, this is called Tathagata Garbha, the womb of the Buddhas. In Chinese, this is called Buddha nature. Buddha nature. You have in your consciousness, at the core of your consciousness, is a light, enlightened awareness. It gets covered up by all this dust, you could say, all this confusion, fear, anger, envy, blah, blah, blah. But in there, it's there. And, when I walked into the Zendo of Genki Takabayashi and I sat down, I felt the earth move, It was like, and I said, this man is the Buddha. But I was wrong. I am the Buddha. You are the Buddha. Genki Roshi was an exemplary human being. And I owe him a huge debt because he was a patient, kindly teacher who made my liberation possible. And if I had $1 million and he needed $1 million, he's dead now, but I would give him $1 million because he is the most wonderful thing that ever happened to me. Meeting him was the best thing that ever happened to me in my life. But, what really happened when I sat down in that Zendo was that my Buddha nature came awake. And Genki's example gave me, you could say, permission, as they say in psychotherapy, gave me permission to listen to that voice. It gave me permission to follow that voice. See, Genki's example gave me permission. Not, I had a director in graduate school. When he found out I was doing meditation, he said, "You are wasting your life." People in my own family opposed my doing this, if you go into New York City, buses drive by and they have advertisements on the side of buses. You never see an advertisement that says, "Seek enlightenment." Right? If you read the New York Times paper, you never read an article, "So-and-so broke through his illusions today." So-and-so, he brought, finally, after 30 years of practice, he heard a stone hit a piece of bamboo and the bottom dropped out of the bucket, You never hear that. So, in our culture, it has some good aspect. Democracy is a wonderful thing. Public education is a great achievement. Medicine, these are all very good, but in other ways, our culture is sick, sick, sick. And its values are very bad, right? And we see that on parade every day. We have Obama on the one side, wonderful human being, best. We have Lincoln, but we also have the Trump. We have this these other aspects, and they have sort of taken over our culture right now. But nobody emphasizes this, so it's easy to think that it's not real. It's easy to not listen to that voice in yourself that says, "On Saturday, get up and come to sit." See, where's it going to get you? Where's it going to get you? You're not going to make any money out of this deal. You're not going to become famous. So where's it going to get you? But sometimes you walk out of the Zendo and you feel so alive, you feel so connected to everything around you. Jaru and I were walking into the Zendo this morning. It was a beautiful morning, and we had sat last night, after sitting last night, walking here in the morning, it was like every blade of grass is alive. If you just keep doing zazen, your life will be like that. But it's, it wasn't Genki Roshi who... Genki Roshi was, you could say, like the catalyst. But what really happened was that Genki Roshi's example gave me permission to listen to the Buddha nature in myself, which I had no confidence in, like most people. I could read, fundamentally we're all Buddha, blah, 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 right? But, you know, when it was a choice between fundamentally we're all Buddha, should I do that or should I, read John Milton one more time and impress my graduate director, I needed to put Milton aside and come and sit. I need to make time for this in my life and honor this in myself. And my self-esteem was so low, as so many people's are, right? I mean, I've told this story before, but, I see graduate students coming into the English department and they turn into, their self-esteem is so low that they imitate their graduate directors. They even sound like their graduate directors. So this is an unhealthy relationship with authority, right? Imitating the authorities, you want to be like your teacher. Now, you can have a healthy relationship with authority if your teacher encourages you to pursue your own questions and offers you support. That's a healthy relationship to authority. So, the Buddha is in you. And our problem is that we don't believe that in a million years. So somebody like Genki Roshi gave me permission to trust that voice in myself. And I don't know what I did in my life. I don't know if I had past lives. I must have done something decent in my past lives because that was the most precious moment. I came in and I sat down and I thought, this is where I need to be. And and I would often come in to sit in the morning and think, what the hell am I doing here? I should be writing my papers. I've got to grade papers. Where is this getting me? And about 15 minutes into the sit, it was like, who cares? And now my Buddha nature was arising and I felt like I was exactly where I had to be. In a wonderful sutra, by the way, is the Lotus Sutra. The Lotus Sutra is so wonderful because it actually deals with some of these issues. In the Lotus Sutra, there's the Buddha, and then the Buddha's sort of most honored arhat, the Buddha's most honored follower. In the original life of the Buddha had like disciples, and they're called arhats. 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 And one of his these are Shariputra, Moggallana. And so on. There's all these famous, just as in Christianity, Jesus is depicted with his disciples. The Buddha is depicted with his arhats. And in, say, Thailand, everybody knows the name of his major arhats, right? And his chief arhat was Shariputra. Shariputra. And everybody understood that Shariputra was deeply enlightened. But in the Lotus Sutra, the Shariputra actually says to the Buddha, everybody says that I'm deeply enlightened, but, I'm actually, and I've been practicing wholeheartedly all these years, and I'm so ashamed because, I'm really not fully enlightened yet. And this would be like, this would be, if you want to understand what this means, this would be like, it would be like a little bit like, I'm trying to think of something in the West, but Shariputra is thought to be the embodiment of enlightenment. And now he says to the Buddha, you know, I'm deeply ashamed because, you know, I haven't really become like you, world-honored one. I haven't fully awakened. And the Buddha says, you know, awakening is not something you attain once and for all. It's a process that goes on and on forever. You know. And when you follow that process, when you allow that process to happen, you're honoring the Buddha nature in yourself. And, you know, then actually it's okay to make mistakes. See, I mean, when I put Genki Roshi on a pedestal, you know, what I was really saying is that I didn't want him to make any mistakes because I was so ashamed of myself, if this is making any sense. You know, I was the screw-up. I was the person who wasn't awake. And I said, Genki Roshi is the opposite of me in every way. He's perfect in every way, and I'm imperfect. And that made Genki Roshi a prisoner of my own projections, but it also made me a prisoner of my own projections. See? And when a teacher like this guy in the Shambhala organization behaves like a 17-year-old goofball and he ought to be spanked, basically, and should be removed. You know, one of the things that makes people want to stop practicing is that they realize that there's a bit of that 17-year-old in them too, yes? And when we discover that there's still that 17-year-old goofball in there, you know, it might undermine our confidence in ourselves all over again, but you just have to realize, you know, that 17-year-old's always going to be there. You know, but also always there is your Buddha nature. You know, and so, you know, even though we continue to behave badly sometimes and make stupid mistakes and be petty and trivial, nevertheless, you know, to follow the great way is to honor that Buddha nature in ourselves, listening to that voice. The process of growing, you know, this is a life process, life practice. You know, at no point until your life is over will your life be done. You know, you're growing and changing. Your horizon is broadening all the time. And the point of the Lotus Sutra is that you're going to keep making... Enlightened people make mistakes, just like unenlightened people. But the difference between somebody like... the difference between somebody like... well, please, when you make mistakes, forgive yourself, get up, and honor the Buddha in yourself. You know, in the West, you know, we feel that when you make mistakes, the thing that you really need is punishment. But I think when we make mistakes, what we really need is to recover our sense of trust in ourselves. You know, we all make mistakes. Please don't get drunk and assault somebody. But even somebody who does that, you know, has Buddha nature. Whatever you do, don't lose trust in that. You know, just if you honor that, you will be able to work through all your obstacles. You'll be able to work through all your mistakes. And there's no way to learn and grow except by making mistakes. There's no way. So in this little story, see, Ganto is afraid of making mistakes. He sees his teacher make a small, really trivial mistake, right? And he's so afraid of making mistakes in himself because he doesn't understand that practice is, you know, we all make mistakes, we all get back on the cushion, and we're true to the Buddha nature in ourselves. And then what happens next time? We make more mistakes. but we get back on the cushion and we're true to the Buddha nature in ourselves. This is what it means to practice the great way. So anyway, Ganto doesn't understand what it means to practice the great way. And or maybe he does, and this is all just a show put on for people who don't understand this yet. But there really isn't such a thing as the last word of Zen. We're all going to continue to make mistakes. Please, when you do that, forgive yourself. Make amends to those you have harmed. And then sit back down on the cushion and continue to honor the Buddha nature in yourself.